Welcome to Cato Audio for February 2020. I'm Caleb Brown. In this month's offering, Stephanie Halfley details lessons from regulatory policy. Wei-Wan Zhu explores how China's trade practices are handled by the World Trade Organization. Greg Nogheim details the trouble with an America First surveillance policy. And Chip Gibbons explains the FBI's problems with the First Amendment. First up, this month's Cato Roundtable. In these uncertain times for freedom around the globe, it's important to sort of reckon with exactly what drives human freedom and what we can do to promote it around the planet. And to discuss the Human Freedom Index, a new product of the Cato Institute, produced for the last several years, co-published with the Fraser Institute and the Liberalis Institute in Germany. I'm talking with Ian Vasquez, who's the head of the Center for Global Liberty and Prosperity at the Cato Institute, and Mustafa Akyol, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, also with the Center for Global Liberty and Prosperity. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
So
thank you.
Let's begin with this. You know, I feel like we seem like a broken record, Ian, every time we sit down and talk about either the economic freedom of the world or the Human Freedom Index. And what is the state of human freedom on planet Earth, and how should we think about it?
Well, what we do with the Human Freedom Index is take a look at all sorts of indicators of economic, personal, and civil freedom. So when we talk about freedom, what we're talking about is the absence of coercive constraint. And so we're looking at 76 different indicators in each country for 162 countries over the course of many years. And so I think that what this index does is it presents a reasonably accurate picture of the state of freedom in the world and the state of freedom within countries. And one of the things that we've seen starting in 2008, which is the date for which we have the earliest data, that surprisingly there's a lot of personal freedom data that didn't exist globally before then, till this latest report, you see a slight decrease in human freedom around the world, with a number of countries increasing, a number of countries decreasing. In fact, the number of countries decreasing their levels of freedom are greater than the number of countries that have increased. 79 have decreased their freedom, 61 countries have increased their freedom over that period of time, and has also included the time of the financial crisis and then recovery from them. So you see a dip in some kinds of freedom, especially in the developed countries that responded to that crisis with increases in the size of government and so on. And many have now recovered in terms of freedom from those points, some not yet fully.
Of most interest to our audience, that is overwhelmingly in the United States, how has the U.S. performed on the Human Freedom Index since 2008 and in this new report?
Well, I think most Americans and much of the world think of the United States as the beacon of freedom in the world. And historically, I think that has largely been true. But when we put together this index, we rank the United States as number 15. Out of 162 countries. That's still fairly free compared to the rest of the world, but I think it's not as free as many of us would like, and certainly not as free as many of us think the United States is. And one of the reasons is because since the year 2000, the United States has seen a long-term decline in terms of its economic freedom that only in recent years has started to go back up again. And yet it is still far below what it was in the year 2000 and in the decades previous to that. The United States always ranked on economic freedom rankings second or third or fourth place. And then it started to go down And so that has played a big role.
And has that been driven by, that ranking has been driven by an actual decline in economic freedom within the United States and not by unnecessarily other countries leapfrogging the U.S. and dramatically increasing economic, civil, and personal freedom?
The fall in its rankings is a reflection of the fall in its actual score and its actual ratings. And if you look again at the economic freedom ratings, all the big indicators have seen a big fall in their scores. The size of government, the rule of law, whether the country has sound money or not, freedom to trade, regulation of business and labor and so on, from the year 2000. Again, these started to recover somewhat in the last several years.
All right. To you, Mustafa Akyol, tell me about the worlds that you study and the countries that are, you know, predominantly Muslim countries. How have they performed in the last 10 years or so?
They have not performed very well, and you can see this clearly in the Freedom Index, Human Freedom Index. The part of the world that I'm really focusing on is, as you said, is the Muslim world. And you can selectively look at the Human Freedom Index and look at the Muslim majority countries. There are about 47 Muslim majority countries. I especially look at those and how they're doing. On average, the freedom levels of the broader Muslim world, these 47 countries, are way below North American and European average, and even the world average. So these are probably the least free parts of the world. There's a clear problem here. However, there are also important nuances that has to be seen. The least free Muslim majority countries, which are also the least free countries right now on Earth, according to the Human Freedom Index, are Syria and Yemen. And why? Well, they're torn by civil war. Then is also Iraq, partly, you know, has gone through a lot of violence, intercommunal violence. So a part of this grim picture comes from civil wars that are due to political factors. Sometimes you can blame outside powers for those, Western powers or Russia or other powers. But when you leave war aside, you again see limited freedom in many Muslim majority countries, especially in the Middle East and North Africa. Saudi Arabia is the country with the least religious freedom in the whole world. I mean, North Korea is not there, so we can measure with that, but it's one of the lowest religious freedom factors in the whole Muslim world. That's the least religiously free country, for example. And data shows that, and I know that by experience. I mean, in Saudi Arabia, there's not a single church or synagogue. I mean, yes, I know that, you know, from reality. And when I look into data, I says, yes, this confirms that. On the other hand, there are Muslim majority countries that are actually relatively quite free, according to world average. Which are those? Well, two of them are in East Europe, Bosnia and Herzegovina and Albania. These are Muslim majority countries, and their freedom levels are close to Greece and Argentina. They're about world average. Why? Well, they're Muslim majority countries, but they have secular governments and they have a tradition of more liberal interpretations of Islam.
They're Western.
They're Western. That's true. There are also countries like Kazakhstan, for example, which have pretty good levels of women's freedom. Kazakhstan is a Muslim majority country, but there is no big traditional patriarchal religious interpretation there that puts women at odds. West African Muslim states are not doing too bad. I mean, Senegal, you know, Burkina Faso, these are the countries that you don't hear that much in the news for anything. They have traditional interpretations of Islam that are not fundamentalist and so on. Whereas when you come to Iran, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, you get into the really dark picture where freedoms are really crushed.
So, Ian, to you, these are questions I ask you every year. I'll say this. When a country is in a good neighborhood with respect to freedom, as talking about Albania and Bosnia-Herzegovina being essentially Western countries, how helpful is it to be bordered by countries that are relatively more free?
I think it's helpful. I will say that we look at 10 different regions in the world in the Human Freedom Index, and one of them is the Middle East and North Africa, which, of course, covers part of the Muslim world. It includes Israel as well, but for the most part, these are Muslim countries. And we find that that is the least free region in the world. It's also the region that has lost the greatest amount of freedom since 2008. So that's a worrisome indicator. But I think that what Mustafa was saying is important. Not all of the Muslim world performs that way, and he gave some examples. So that's important. This is a pattern we see in different parts of the world, but we also see divergences. Several decades ago, it would be easier to say that most of Latin America performs similarly. That's no longer the case. First of all, for most of the region, freedom has increased, like in much of the world during that time period. But then we've seen countries like Venezuela, like Argentina, take a dive in terms of overall freedoms, not just economic freedoms. And so you see countries that have been very successful, like Peru and Chile, and in terms of increasing their levels of overall freedom, and countries that are going backward, even in the same neighborhood, so to speak.
So what are the relationships among economic, personal, and civil freedom? Can you point to a driver and say, this gives rise to the others?
I think that it may be premature to say that, but one thing that we can say is that economic freedom and personal freedom are strongly associated. And so I like to say that if you want to live in a country with a relatively high level of personal freedoms, you should want to live in a country with a relatively high level of economic freedom. It's hard to maintain those other freedoms if you don't have economic freedom to accompany it. I mean, somebody once said that the control of economics is the control of life itself, which is true. That's one of the reasons why dictators like to control the economy. They get control over every other decision in life that you have. And so that relationship is important. And I think that that's one of the important findings of the Human Freedom Index, because there are a lot of genuine advocates of human rights, press freedoms, and so on, who don't often enough fully appreciate the importance of economic freedom as part of the broad freedoms that we should cherish.
I can remember a few years ago, we had a lot of refugees or people coming from Cuba. Many of these people were, NPR had sort of characterized them as economic refugees, not political refugees, as if this made their plight less serious. And I guess that's maybe a pervasive attitude among folks in the media, that if you're trying to get a better life economically, that's somehow not as oppressive. You weren't coming from as oppressive a regime if, say, your right to vote was being abrogated.
And it's not just a perception that might exist in the media. It's also legal understanding that the U.S. law for allowing some kinds of refugees in is more permissive if they're actually suffering from other kinds of deprivations or repression of their rights.
So how did North America do? The United States, Canada, Mexico were about to sign off finally on a revised North American free trade agreement called something else. But, how are our neighbors doing?
Well, actually, as I say, the United States is number 15, but Canada is one of the freest countries in the world. It's number 4 on our ranking. The top countries are New Zealand, followed by Switzerland and Hong Kong, and then Canada, followed by Australia and Denmark and Luxembourg. So we're in a good neighborhood, but Mexico falls way behind. It really performs in a very mediocre way. It's number 92. And that's really one of the big disappointments of Latin America. The United States borders Mexico. It's had a free trade agreement with it for years, which has benefited it and the United States tremendously. But for that reason and the whole host of other advantages that Mexico should have, we should expect really that Mexico should be the star performer of Latin America, and it hasn't been the case. And that's because of a number of reforms that they simply have not done, as has been the case in other Latin American countries. And this has been one of its huge problems. It's still a country with very mediocre levels of economic freedom. It's almost as if it were two countries. The country that is engaged internationally with all of its free trade agreements and so on, and that performs very competitively in its export sector and anything that's connected to it. And then the rest of the country that has not been connected to that side of the economy. And so you have kind of two Mexicos, and this has been a problem that has not been resolved in Mexico through the necessary reforms. I think also that has also led to tremendous frustrations that in turn have generated support for the current populism in the country right now.
So, going forward, you said that the data that we have for the Human Freedom Index essentially begins in 2008. A lot of this data was not available, but of course, the Economic Freedom of the World Index has been produced for far longer than that. And of course, data lags behind events. Right now, we're watching unrest in Hong Kong. There's unrest in France. And several countries, really. So, watching those events unfold now, where should we expect, or can we have any expectations for a country like Hong Kong that for so long has been one of the freest in the world?
The unrest that's going on in Hong Kong really represents a battle for freedom against one of the most threatening tyrannies and strengthening tyrannies in the world, which is, of course, China. And so this was a battle that's important not just for Hong Kong, but for the rest of the world as we try to figure out how to deal with the growing dictatorship and the power of that dictatorship in China and in the region. I'm not terribly optimistic about Hong Kong because Hong Kong has been a beacon of freedom. It's been number one on our indexes up until recently. It's still number one in terms of economic freedom. But to the extent that China increases its interventions in Hong Kong, it'll lead to continued deteriorations in the rule of law and in press freedoms. We're already seeing that happen. Our data goes up to 2017 because that's how the data lags. But we have seen this deterioration in Hong Kong over the course of that time period. And I think that we can expect that, unfortunately, that trend to continue. Hong Kong is still a very free place, and the Hong Kong people are still cherishing their freedoms very much. One of the things they don't have is, of course, political freedom, and that's one of the things that they're calling for. They view, and I think it is now becoming true, they view democracy as one of the mechanisms by which they can guarantee a high level of freedom. I think that's true in their case at this point, where we see what Beijing is doing. And in fact, in the Human Freedom Index, we correlate the level of overall human freedom with democracy, and we find a very strong relationship. As we know, it's sometimes under democracy we can lose freedoms, and that certainly happened in many countries. So that's not a guarantee that freedom will be maintained or maintained at a high rate. In fact, I expect that if Hong Kong does become democratic at some point, it's economic freedom will probably go down. A lot of the people who are advocating for democracy also believe in a lot more types of government interventionism, which we believe reduces people's freedom of choice, but not in any way that is unusual for developed countries.
Who are some of the biggest surprises? I know that in Africa, we always point to Mauritius as a country that performs above expectations. Mauritius is, of course, very small, fairly isolated. But what were some of the countries that are big surprises, big gainers, or big losers?
Well, over the course of a couple of years, you don't usually see big increases or big drops. Even over the course of 10 years or less, you don't see tremendous changes. But if you look at the top quartile of countries in the Human Freedom Index, one thing really stands out, and that is that countries from around the world are represented in that group of the freest countries in the world. And if you were to have created an index like this 30 years ago, that simply would not be the case. Today, we have several countries in Asia that are in the top. It's not just Hong Kong. It's Japan. It's Taiwan. We have, of course, North American countries. We have European countries. We even have Chile and Uruguay. This is Latin America. Mauritius is a country that comes in 50th place. So it's close, but that's a symbol of progress as well, because it didn't used to be that you could find very many sub-Saharan African countries moving up. And there are others, Suriname and Ghana and so on, that perform well. Another thing I should mention is that the quartile of the freest countries in the index also includes a number of formerly socialist countries, like Estonia and like Lithuania, like Poland, and so on. This is another measure of the tremendous progress that the world has made in terms of freedom, and that freedom works not just in the Anglo-Saxon countries or not just in the Western European countries, and it can be achieved and sustained by all sorts of different societies and people from around the world.
So, but the unfortunate fact for countries like Estonia is that they have a fairly recent experience with being dominated under socialism.
That is an unfortunate fact. But
right,
the unfortunate fact is that they've gotten away from that.
But is that a prerequisite? But is that that is a lot of countries that suffered under communism or socialism a few decades ago have not necessarily achieved the kind of results that Estonia has.
That's right. We now have had some 30 years or so of experience in the so-called transition era from the plan to the market, and some countries have done much better than others in terms of not just reforms, but economic growth and achievement of human well-being. And what we found is that the countries that did the most far-reaching, most comprehensive reforms in the fastest period of time achieved the best results, including in terms of institutional development, the development of the rule of law, the development of democratic institutions. They're stronger in those countries that did the more far-reaching reforms, as compared to ones like Russia or in Central Asia that really didn't do much in terms of reforms, and they're lagging in terms of freedom and in a lot of other indicators as well. I think that the countries that did the most to reform and have reaped the best, the greatest benefits are also well placed to maintain them as more than many other countries, because the experience with communism is still not that far away. And this is not an abstract concept for much of the population, and that helps.
Yeah. Mustafa, with respect to your home country, Turkey, what can we say about it?
Well, when the Human Freedom Index came out, one of the first things I did was to look at Turkey. How's it doing? And of course, Turkey is one of the big disappointments, I mean, from a freedom perspective. It's one of the actually countries which had the most dramatic decline in its freedom in the past decade. But also there was something interesting. When you look at from 2008 to today, 2017, which is all under Erdogan, President Erdogan, he was prime minister back then. At first, you see actually an increase in freedom until 2011. These were the good years of Erdogan and his party, AKP. I personally was sympathetic at the time. And then you start to see a U-turn and then a very dramatic decline, which is what political observers would think what happened. And I was happy to see that our data really confirms that. I think Turkey has become an example of a country where democracy, quote unquote, means nothing other than ballots and rule of law, freedom of the press, freedom of expression are just decimated. If democracy, quote unquote, means just ballots, whoever gets 51% can establish a tyranny of the majority. And we know that from, you know, we know that from history, from theory. And I think Turkey has been that, has been a stark example of that. I still hope for a recovery for Turkey in the future. So I think it's not a done deal. But right now, its freedom ratings have gone dramatically low, and it's one of the worrying cases in the world.
The Human Freedom Index is co-published with the Fraser Institute and the Liberales Institute in Germany. Thank you to Ian Vasquez and Mustafa Akyol. You can get your copy of the Human Freedom Index at our website, cato.org. Policy interventions often carry unintended consequences. In Stephanie Halfley's co-edited volume, The Need for Humility in Policymaking, Lessons from Regulatory Policy, the authors make the case that the complexity of human decision-making and the incentives that drive human behavior are critical to understanding the effects of policy. She spoke at the Cato Institute in January.
Great. Thank you, Chelsea and the Cato Institute, for inviting us to do a book forum on the need for humility in policymaking, Lessons from Regulatory Policy. As she mentioned, it's an edited volume by myself and Anne Hobson. The volume, which came out with Roman and Littlefield International this year, highlights policy research by alumni of the MA Fellowship Program, which you heard about from my bio and Anne's, and also what we think is a major lesson for policy, humility. In this presentation, I'll go over the framework utilized in the book to examine policy, and then Anne will discuss the contributors and some of the case studies used. And we hope to have plenty of time for Q&A, so I hope while you made it out here today in the cold, you're also ready to talk about these ideas and to consider a more humble approach to policymaking. All right, so sort of start us off the bat, why humility, particularly in policymaking, particularly in this time period of policymaking? Policymaking as a modern context is built upon the tradition of professional bureaucracy that was implemented and advocated by Woodrow Wilson and the rise of the progressive era. Technocrats can tweak the market to stem market failures. They can redistribute wealth to better serve citizens. They can negotiate security threats and aid other countries in time of war and humanitarian crises. Government can nudge citizens to better align their actions with their goals or incentivize behavioral changes. Policy wonks spend their days debating the nuances of particular policies, arguing for tweaks and adjustments that would better serve the population. To think about it in the terms of regulatory policy, it's even kind of more stark. As it's grown more technocratic over time, many in attempts to do better regulations to better serve the people, we look at particular issues like can we put a price on people's lives? How do we figure out which alternatives have the best cost and benefits? These are all in efforts to get us to think about alternatives and to possibly think about when we might not deregulation. But even in this push for a more technocratic, but potentially more humble approach to regulatory policymaking, we don't necessarily see assessments after the fact or adjustments after the fact or repealing regulations that might no longer work. And so this book tries to look at how we might take that approach and think about how to be more humble, particularly in regulatory policy. Expertise is the prime currency for policymaking. It's formal administrative training, scholars who have spent their lives discussing these ideas, and leadership skills from other sectors become really popular. Politicians love to talk about expertise as well. We hear about the role that business owners can come in and shake up with policymaking. President Trump, while campaigning for the presidency in 2016, boldly claimed that only I can fix it. His claim that his skill in business would make him an effective president persuaded many. Now, Michael Bloomberg has entered the Democratic primary race, saying he is actually the businessman who can beat Trump and fix Washington. He says he's a doer and a problem solver, not a talker. But if we want to have a more humble approach to policymaking, if we want to figure out what might work best for the nation, we might need to talk a little bit before we do. And so how do we think about that as we're going through it? We might turn to policy wonks as political leaders. And with that, we see examples as Elizabeth Warren running that she has a plan to implement for many of her policy issues that she talks about on the campaign trail. The role for policymaking and policymakers and analysts is ever growing. You might say it's a great time to be in DC and have some pretty good job security for all of us working in policy. Yet, the world is messy and complex. Circumstances change, new information enters our lives every day, and so does innovation. The political, economic, and social life is dynamic, and it's interconnected. The 2008 financial crisis is a good example of this. It wasn't any particular sector, maybe one could be blamed more than others that we might think about here, but it wasn't necessarily just the fact that banks were trying to get a lot of people to own homes. It was also that government had a stand in that, and that altogether people were making these decisions that were impacted by government action, by drives to own homes and to build communities in a way that we might not have otherwise seen. This interconnected policy impacts market activity. New innovations change the bureaucratic landscape and the landscape for regulation. Welfare is the subject of government, but also of civil society. Tweaking the system leads to all sorts of consequences and changes. And an important consequence of policy is that it affects real life humans who can learn and adapt. Let's consider a policy aimed at reducing the consumption of junk food. We just had a holiday weekend. We probably all overindulged a little bit, or hope that we did if we stayed true to our diets or plans. So let's say we might get on board with an idea that a soda tax would help us change our behavior and drink less soda and consume less junk food. Depending on the tax and its structure and how many things are impacted, people might just shift their activities to different sugary drinks that they're interested in. Notoriously, in a lot of these soda tax, things like Frappuccinos, certain energy drinks, or even really sweet tea if you're from the South, aren't implemented in those policies. And of course, the policy might not adjust behavior at all if the tax is too low. And that might be true if the real goal isn't to change behavior, but to increase revenues and not necessarily curb the bad eating habits of our fellow citizens. Another example is to consider the ingenuity of the sharing economy, where people engaged in what our colleague Adam Thier calls permissionless innovation. They disrupted lodging and transportation sectors in a way we could never have anticipated, and regulators had to take a step and try to catch up after they were implemented. Many occupational licensing that was utilized before became ineffective, and there was backlash, but also an attempt to figure out how this new dynamic system was going to impact society. Now, today, we have hopefully less drunk drivers because there's more Ubers and taxis around to do so. We can think about all the different ways that we can travel and feel more at home with Airbnb and other places. However, the sharing economy isn't all roses. Now that they've been implemented and they've been able to push some regulations back, they're now lobbying for some of their own regulations and to keep some of their competitors at bay. And so this complicated world where we might have a hero one day and a lobbying organization we need to worry about the next matters when we think about policy. Another way to think about this is the rich evade higher taxes. Teenagers know how to sneak into their houses after they've broken curfew. People figure out the parking spots that are less likely to get ticketed if they don't have. It's particularly true on the Fairfax campus of GMU, figuring out how to kind of get around some of the high parking fees. People are crafty, and they're incentivized to get around overly burdensome and costly regulations. Whether imposed by themselves, their parents, their community, or their government. And particularly when we're thinking about kind of broad brush policies at the federal level, those are going to have major unintended consequences, particularly with all sorts of communities. Some, like the soda tax, might not deal with or affect a good chunk of the population who isn't interested in eating a lot of junk food. It might, in fact, maybe be regressive and hurt low-income populations more than anticipated. So how do we go about understanding behavior and the implications of policy? Our book and our perspective talks about what Pete Becky, one of our colleagues, calls mainline economics. And we think mainline economics provides the framework needed to study this messy and complicated world and to bring about a more humble policymaking.
For all the legitimate concerns and more than a little bluster about China's unfair trade practices, how does the country respond when challenged at the World Trade Organization? Wei Wanzhu is author of China's Implementation of the Rulings of the World Trade Organization. He spoke at the Cato Institute in December.
So the book, the completion of the book dragged for about a couple of years. But the issue we're asking, or the question we're asking today, remains very alive, which is, does China comply with the rulings or the rules of the WTO? That question has many aspects into it, and the answer to that to those questions or the different aspects might differ, depend on which aspect you're looking at it. So, there are two particular aspects that we're going to discuss today, as Simon alluded to. One is whether China complies with the WTO obligations in general. And the second one is whether China complies with the WTO rulings against it when China lost a case. So the book is focusing on the second question, the secondary compliance, if you like. But we're going to talk about both of the questions today, maybe in the Q&A session. But let me just focus on the first question by now. The compliance with the WTO rulings. The book was completed around the same time last year. By the time, there were about 43 disputes against China as a respondent, involving 30 matters. Now, since then, there has been one more dispute, I think. And then there is, among the 30 disputes, China has been a respondent and lost all of the, most of the cases in 12 disputes. And in 10 disputes, China chose to reach a mutually agreed solution with the complainants, which means that China either modifies or removes the mayor's concerns without going through the adjudication process. Within the 12 disputes that China lost the WTO case and has to implement, China implemented almost in all cases. There was only one case where China failed to implement completely. Now, let me be clear. The cases may involve many, many aspects, many, many issues there, and the findings of the WTO tribunals could involve different issues or different findings or violations. China's compliance has been very well because China complied in almost all cases, except for one. Now, the two issues, one in relation to the restriction on trading rights, in relation to films, China reached a compensation deal with the US, basically by providing more market access to the US in exchange for non-compliance. The second aspect, in the same case, which is the China publications, the audiovisual products case, China actually removed the prohibition in relation to the right for foreign investors, enterprises to run network music activities. But after that, China did not publish any law or regulation for foreign investors, enterprises to follow in applying for approval to run such businesses. So that was considered as a partial compliance. But only in those two issues, aspects, that China failed to comply. In all of the other cases involving many, many other issues, China complied completely. Now, when I say China complied completely, there is another nuanced issue we need to bring up, which is trade remedy cases. Now, in trade remedy cases, China's compliance is a little bit more trickier because China's approach has been to reinvestigate the same matter after an adverse WTO ruling. That means that the final outcome of the reinvestigation could either be the removal of the existing duties or continuation of the existing duties at the same or modified rates. Now, we can come back to this point in the Q&A session, but the general point I want to make is that despite that, compliance issues in trade remedy cases is not a China-specific issue. If you want to take an example of Azerion cases and also other trade remedy cases, you can see the issue is generally applicable to all WTO members, and especially the major users of trade remedies. So I think the overall conclusion is that China has maintained a very good record of compliance. I think from my comparison, I haven't done a comparison in the book, but the comparison with the US records, the EU records, China has maintained a better record of compliance. And also consider the fact that China has not been subject to any request for authorization for retaliation in the system. So which again indicates that China has maintained a quality compliance in most of the cases. Now, what is the policy implication from that? The policy implication is that the WTO dispute settlement mechanism has been effective in reducing China to make changes. That is one of the reasons I think that the current administration has been wrong in at least diminishing the function and effectiveness of the system. What WTO members should continue to do is to use the system effectively to continue to push China to make necessary changes in policy making and regulation. So that is the main policy implications I think that I need to emphasize on. Having said that, China has many issues after compliance in individual cases. Now, these issues, I just mentioned two major ones. I think it's quite important. The first one is implementation and transparency, which means that once you have a revised law in China in compliance with WTO rulings, the implementation process must be monitored effectively and continuously. Now, to be able to monitor it, we need to have a transparency system in China to really say whether at both the central and local levels, China has implemented the revised law in an effective way. That has been missing, and that's one of the major issues I think currently we're still having in relation to China's post-compliance activities. The second one is what I termed as the repetitive violation. It's really concerns about the new development of regulation in China to deal with the same regulatory objectives. In those areas, China may use similar measures for the same purpose. Consider the export restrictions on raw materials and rare earths. In these cases, the repetitive violation is likely because it's very similar measures trying in pursuit of the very similar objectives just after a finding of violation by WTO tribunals. But again, that is not a China-specific issue. All of the WTO members can use the weakness of the system, which is, as Jim and Simon have written a paper about it, it's a lengthy litigation and compliance process, which provides significant gap for temporary breaches. And one of the solutions, as Jim and Simon argue for, is to shorten the process and simplify the whole process so that you have a shorter time for any potential temporary breach. Another solution, as I would argue, but as has been talked about for a long time, is to introduce retrospective remedies. Having said that, I think one last thing I want to mention is we need to be careful when we assess the objectively whether any country complies with the WTO rulings. The dispute settlement mechanism itself has its limits. So in individual cases, the rulings will be based on the issues brought by a complainant. And the final ruling, even though you may be overall in favor of a complainant, it may have more limited effects because you may not be fully in supportive of the complainants. So we need to really look at the specific aspects of a violation found by the WTO tribunals to be able to measure compliance objectively. But that also shows the limitation of the dispute settlement mechanism itself. But despite that limitation, I think the WTO's dispute settlement mechanism has been very effective in inducing China in complying with the WTO rulings to make changes. If you ask a Chinese official, as I did, they will tell you that one of the most confident things that the government will tell you about their performance in the WTO in general is compliance with the rulings. And that has been treated as a priority by the government, at least in the past 18 years. So I think, again, maintaining a functional dispute settlement mechanism is the way to deal with China. If we are going to deal with any China-specific challenges in the future, we need to maintain a functional dispute settlement mechanism, and we should continue to support the panel review mechanism, as well as the WTO or the multilateral treaty system in general.
At the Cato Institute's surveillance conference held late last year, a variety of experts came together to lay out their concerns about surveillance. We feature two speakers from that conference. First up, Greg Nogheim with the Center for Democracy and Technology details the global implications of an America First surveillance policy. Also from Cato's surveillance conference in December, Chip Gibbons with Defending Rights and Dissent offered his thoughts on the FBI's ongoing problem of First Amendment abuse.
Hello, everyone. Again, I'm Greg Nogheim with the Center for Democracy and Technology, www.cdt.org. I want to talk about the global implications of what I call America First surveillance policy. And when I say America First, I often mean Americans first. U.S. surveillance policy, particularly on the intelligence side of the equation, discriminates in favor of Americans and against foreigners in a fairly dramatic way when it comes to surveillance that occurs outside the United States. Inside the United States, it's actually relatively even between Americans and foreigners. In both cases, when the government wants to surveil a person in the United States and collect their communications content for intelligence purposes, it has to show that the person is an agent of a foreign power, an agent of an entity like a foreign terrorist organization or a foreign government. That requirement is a very high level of proof, probable cause, that the person is an agent of a foreign power. And it has to be done in front of a judge, in front of a judge in the super secret FISA court. But outside the United States, international intelligence surveillance directed at foreigners doesn't have those protections. If conducted under Executive Order 12333, there's no probable cause requirement, no requirement that the person be an agent of their government or of a foreign terrorist organization, and no judge making any determination at all. Any activities and intentions of a foreigner are fair game, and bulk collection, that means non-targeted collection, is acknowledged. Internationally, for foreigners who are using U.S. Cloud providers, the news isn't very much better. That surveillance is conducted under Section 702. You heard a lot about that on the last panel. Suffice it to say, no probable cause, no determination that the target is an agent of a foreign power, and no judge is approving individual targets. Judges approve programmatic surveillance based on these certifications, but there's no determination with respect to individual targets. And any information relevant to U.S. foreign policy or national security is fair game. So America First surveillance policies can dramatically impact the rights of foreigners because the standards are low and the U.S. government's ability to access communications is very high, especially relative to other countries. It's high in part because so many of the large providers are located in the United States. But America First also diminishes the rights of Americans. And I say that because we Americans communicate more than ever with foreigners who are abroad. Even our domestic-to-domestic communications can be routed abroad, where they might be subject to these more permissive surveillance regimes. By targeting foreigners, the U.S. government collects communications of people in the United States intentionally incidentally. That means we intend to collect the communications of Americans who are communicating with foreign targets. And that's called incidental communication, but it is intended. By targeting foreigners applying low standards, the U.S. government amasses a database of communications that includes many communications of Americans, and then it turns around and queries that data for Americans' communications without probable cause, without a determination that the American is an agent of a foreign power, and without judicial authorization. So the result of the America First surveillance policy is a diminution in the rights of Americans. By failing to extend even basic protections to the foreigners, we allow this database of communications to grow and grow quite huge, and it includes the communications of Americans because we often communicate with foreigners abroad and because some communications are collected in that database, even though they are domestic to domestic. So America First offers very little protection to foreigners, and it also diminishes the protections that would be otherwise available to Americans. Now, I've talked about America First in the intelligence context because that's where it's most pronounced. In the context of criminal surveillance, where the government is actually investigating a crime, there hadn't been, until last year, a distinction between Americans and foreigners. Everybody got basically the same rights. The Cloud Act, adopted in 2018, for the first time, extended a version of America First to criminal surveillance. Under the agreement that the United States just entered into with the UK, the UK can compel disclosures of stored content and of content in real time under UK law, which is more permissive than is US law, of all surveillance targets except for Americans and except for people physically present in the United States. That's really the first time that criminal surveillance laws have distinguished between Americans and everyone else. America First on the criminal side of the equation can have the same adverse effect on Americans that it does in the intelligence side. For example, under the Cloud Act, the UK can share back to the United States government communications that involve Americans that were incidentally collected when others were targeted. That sharing back is done without probable cause, without the intervention of a judge. Now, the next big test for whether we will continue to extend America First, which, as I've said, is not even protecting Americans, the next big test is going to be a treaty that's currently being negotiated between the United States, the Council of Europe, and other governments. That treaty is a protocol to an existing treaty called the Budapest Cybercrime Convention. This protocol is designed to permit cross-border demands for communications traffic data, think of an email log, for example, and for subscriber information. The theory of this, of provision 5 of this protocol will be that parties who sign it will be required to give effect, that's the language of the current draft, to give effect to the orders issued by other signatory countries to this convention for traffic data and for subscriber information. So this is not about content, it's for traffic data and for subscriber information. How would a country give effect to the foreign order? Well, the protocol says how it could do that. It could do that by accepting it as equivalent to a domestic order, by endorsing it, or by issuing its own legal process, which I presume would be based on facts that are provided by the foreign government. The U.S. could give effect to a foreign order to, for example, disclose a log of your email or your browsing history, I think, based on a demand issued without judicial review from a Budapest Cybercrime Convention Protocol signatory like Hungary, Turkey, Russia, Albania, or Ukraine. Ukraine. Did I say Ukraine? Yes, Ukraine. It is a signatory to the Budapest Convention, the Cybercrime Convention. Presumably, it will sign the protocol to the Budapest Cybercrime Convention. A mile down the road from this conference, there is a big discussion among members of Congress about whether to remove from office the President of the United States because he attempted to list Ukraine in an effort to investigate his political rival, Joe Biden, through his son, Hunter Biden, who had a position on the board of directors of a company in Ukraine. How would Ukraine investigate Hunter Biden? What would it do? More than half of criminal investigations today involve electronic evidence. One could presume that what Ukraine would do would be to seek email logs from Hunter Biden. Hunter Biden, presumably using a US provider, his email logs are stored by that provider and could become available to the foreign government under the Budapest Convention. Today, even today, the providers can volunteer this information. US law has a flaw. In my view, it's a flaw that permits foreign governments to obtain even your email logs without there being any restriction except what the foreign government itself applies.
The name of the report is Still Spying on Dissent, the Enduring Problem of FBI First Amendment Abuse. And as the name would indicate, both by the still spying as well as the enduring problem, that this is a continuous problem, it's not a new one, and it's been with us for a long time. So what does it mean that we have this long history of FBI political surveillance? Well, at a certain point, we no longer start to treat these types of revelations as exceptional. They either become very normalized or they become very sort of almost invisible. You know, conversely, if you talk to activists, they'll make jokes like, oh, we know the FBI spy on us, or oh, we know someone's infiltrating us. They treat it as normal. On the other hand, because it's not exceptional and therefore not always newsworthy, people who should know better will not even realize it's going on. A few years ago, I was accompanying a gentleman from an anti-war group who had been spied on and infiltrated by the FBI to meet with congressional offices. And we were asking for Congress to investigate that surveillance as well as the surveillance against Occupy Wall Street and Black Lives Matter. I won't say what office we were in, but the representative was very concerned about the Fourth Amendment, very concerned with the NSA, and the staffer we were talking to was very up on those issues. And we went through the whole presentation and laid out all of the facts, and the staffer just said to us, I had no idea the FBI still did that. It's sort of perverse. On the one hand, the fact that it's an enduring problem means we accept it as normal, or on the other hand, people who should know better act like it's doesn't realize it's going on. And I think one of the reasons we wrote the report is to push back on this narrative we see. There's a lot of bad narratives in the media about the FBI. But one in particular I find troubling, which is when we treat these instances of abuse as isolated incidents. So when we are so lucky that someone in the mainstream media will cover an FBI abuse, they'll be like, oh, the FBI visited Standing Rock water protectors, or oh, new documents show the FBI spied on Occupy Wall Street. But they never say, hey, today we learned the FBI was knocking on the doors of water protectors. Last month, we found out they were knocking on the doors of Palestine solidarity activists. And last year, we discovered that they were spying on Occupy Wall Street, indicating that the problem is widespread, severe, systemic, and part of a 110-year political tradition on behalf of our friends in the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So by putting together all of these different incidents since 2010, and the reason we picked 2010 is not just because it's the end of the decade, though that would have been a good reason to do so, but because in 2010, the OIG for the Department of Justice released a report called A Review of the FBI Monitoring of Certain Domestic Advocacy Organizations. As you can tell, since they got the more exciting title, we had to settle for the more banal title of Still Spying on Dissent. But that's the last time there's been an official review of FBI spying. And that review covers the Bush era, released in 2010, but covers the Bush era. And just 4 days after the OIG released that report, the FBI was raiding the homes of anti-war and Palestine solidarity activists across the Midwest. So what's happened since 2010? What do we know about? We know that before the first protester ever set foot in Zuccotti Park, the FBI was monitoring Occupy Wall Street. We know that the FBI was monitoring Black Lives Matter as early as Ferguson, and extremely disturbingly, they have come up with an intelligence assessment about the threat of Black identity extremism. And the logic behind this assessment is extraordinarily insidious. It says that if African Americans are upset about police violence, police racism, and social injustice, they may engage in lethal retaliatory violence against police, and police should be aware of this terror threat. And we know through other leaked documents, they created an entire program called Iron Fist. Think about that name for a minute. Iron Fist to quote unquote mitigate the threat of Black identity extremism. And what that argument is saying is that not only is it that First Amendment protected political expression is some sort of precursor to criminality, but people, by being rightfully upset at social injustices that are pervasive in our society that they experience, they endure, they should, that is a precursor to crime. Other things we know about is they were at Standing Rock, they've visited a bunch of anti-pipeline protesters, they've been visiting the homes of Palestinian solidarity activists, and I also spent about 5 years pursuing a FOIA request and lawsuit against the FBI in relationship to their surveillance of pro-Palestine groups that hopefully you'll be hearing about more about later this month. We know that they were at Occupy and Abolish ICE. We know they've been at pretty much every, they've visited proponents of Cuban normalization at their homes and asked them questions. So we know that pretty much every major political movement of the last decade, the FBI has been there watching, monitoring, surveilling, and in some cases, engaging in disruptive tactics I'll talk about later. So although the report is about 2010 to the present, I hope you'll permit me to go back in time just a few years to 1908, which is when the FBI was founded while Congress was on recess. And to this day, the FBI has no congressional charter, no legislative charter, which is something that's been consistently very vexing to civil libertarians like myself. In 1919, J. Edgar Hoover's name was not yet on a building, but he was getting his start at the then Bureau of Investigation in what was originally called the Radical Division, not because they were radical, but because they were spying on radicals, and what was later renamed the General Intelligence Division. And I know this seems like ancient history, it's 100 years ago, but there's some really important things to extrapolate from this. First of all, this is not abnormal. It's not just Hoover is a weird guy. Sometimes histories of surveillance will get very personalized about him. I mean, different police departments around the country were developing what were called Red Squads, which, like the Radical Division, were also intelligence divisions, which brings me to my second part of the equation, which is that the FBI is not only a law enforcement agency, and in theory, law enforcement is about gathering evidence that can be used to prosecute a crime. We can dispute whether or not that's what they really do or not, but that's the theory, but also about intelligence, which is far more permissive and far more broad. And that so you have this trend of people who think that it's valid for police to have intelligence divisions, like the Red Squad, like the General Intelligence Division, to track, you know, labor unrest, anarchists, socialists, and other sort of undesirables, and that Hoover comes out of that tradition and then becomes the director of the FBI.
The United States ranks 15th in the 5th Annual Human Freedom Index, the most comprehensive measure of freedom ever created for a large number of countries around the globe. Co-published by the Cato Institute, the index presents the state of human freedom in the world based on 76 distinct indicators of personal, civil, and economic freedom. Visit cato.org today and download your copy of the 5th Annual Human Freedom Index and learn more about the state of human freedom. That will do it for this edition of Cato Audio. I'm Caleb Brown. Talk to you again next month.